Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the fourth English version of the Breaking Blinds podcast. I'm your host, Zach Lowy. I'm here with world-renowned journalist Christian Hinaj.
Oh wow, I thought that was going to be Andreas's introduction, not
No.
mine.
And beIN Sports commentator Andres Cordero.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah, it's box-to-box broadcaster. Gentlemen, it is a privilege to have you both on today. Thank you both for coming on. Before we start, I just want to congratulate Andres on, what is it now, 19 days of fatherhood.
Yeah, thanks, man. What by the way, if you hear somebody crying in the background, it's not him, it's me. I haven't had much sleep.
Hey,
But
you know what they say, the first 19 days are always the
right. It's
hardest.
absolutely brilliant, though. My wife and I just had our first son, and he's
Oh yeah.
tremendous. So we're still floating on a cloud.
That's great. What's his name?
Axel.
Axel. Well, Axel always has a place at Breaking Blinds, so
On.
let him know for potential employers. All right. So let's get this thing going. So the Champions League draw was today, the Europa League draw was today, but we also saw several stories from the quarterfinals. Going into El Clasico on Sunday, the last El Clasico of Luis Enrique's reign, what is there to make of it? Barcelona just had their third quarterfinals elimination in 4 years, and I think that a lot of people try to link them, make it seem like it's the same as the Barcelona of Guardiola and previous years, but I think a lot has changed. So what's the outlook going into El Clasico and going into the post Luis Enrique era?
Person.
It's a funny one because I feel like everyone's had the obituary for Barcelona saved in their drafts for a long time. Even just this week, you see people talking about it being the end of the year. I think you have to give a little bit of credit to Rory Smith because he wrote quite the opposite. But the thing is, for me with Luis Enrique, and I was talking to David Cartledge, who is based in Barcelona and moves around Spain. It never really seemed like Enrique was the right fit for the intensity of this job, because Spanish clubs, I think more than any in Europe, are very political. There's a lot of inner conflict that seeps through because of the fans and their relationship to the structure and the organization. And for Barcelona in particular, you need to have that sort of buffer between the hierarchy and then the players. And I just don't think Enrique was about that. I think he's a bit of a purist almost for me. He wants to just coach, nothing too complicated. And there are a lot of clubs where you can do that. I don't think Barcelona is one of them. And it's funny because when I was talking to David, we've met twice in the last few months while he's been back home in Durham. And I would say about a week before he confirmed Luis Enrique that he was going to leave, David said, "I think he's going to leave. I think he's tired of it. I think he's just going to spend a few months cycling or something like that just to recharge his
He does
batteries."
love his cycling.
And it's that thing of, I mean, the Clásico is again another isolated moment where he needs them to perform. He needs them to really kick on. But having watched them now against Juventus and Sociedad, I wasn't that impressed with them in either game. I think they'll get more chances against Real Madrid comparative to Juventus, because for me, Juventus are possibly the one of, if not the best defensive side
Exactly.
in Europe at the moment. And that's not to say that they don't attack, but from an organizational standpoint, I think they're one of, if not the best. So the future of Barcelona, I think they have to decide what they want the future to be, because it's fair to say the generation that came through the academy that is so interwoven in the more than a club ethos they have is slowly fading away now. So you have to decide, are we going to go out and try and handpick these global stars like we did with Neymar and Suarez, or are we going to put more efforts back into La Masia and breed something there? Because I think there's been perhaps just a little bit of negligence with that side of things. You know,
Oh,
the
I'd say
fact
a little bit more than a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good, it's more than negligence. It's in some sense a bit of a deconstruction. You know, some key members of La Masia, people who had been around for quite some time, had been just sort of removed by this administration, the same administration, if you extend it to Sandro Rosell, that sort of stripped Johan Cruyff of that honorary presidency. And so they didn't seem to be in line with maybe the Laporta era and with Frank Rijkaard when they were bringing players up through, you know, even before Pep Guardiola's arrival, bringing Barcelona B kids up. And you can see when you watch Barca B play that there's still talent there. And this kid, Carles Alenya, who we've barely seen, even though that has been a position that hasn't really, center midfield hasn't really been, you know, shining for Barcelona all season. I think Rakitic has been below the level that he showed the previous season. Andre Gomes is not really impressed and hasn't taken that, hasn't been convincing in that role despite being given every opportunity. Opportunities that maybe Denis Suarez did not get. And we didn't see much of, enough maybe of Suarez and certainly barely none of Carles Alenya. So it has shifted. I think this is the most Madrid-like Barcelona we've seen in some times, where they are out to make the blockbuster signings, where it is more about the sort of the corporation rather than the football club. And in terms of the Luis Enrique point that, that Christian, you touched on, I think you're right that it was always going to expire at some point, but Luis Enrique is going to leave with sort of legendary status in terms of the titles he's won, right, in the first two seasons, but not so in terms of his reputation. I think his reputation, even having won the treble, sure, Barcelona fans were happy, whereas maybe they weren't as thrilled to welcome him to the club because of the stylistic differences, the aesthetic differences between his Barca and his predecessors. But I think he'll leave having felt that he stuck around 1 year too long, because he has seemed from the beginning of the season just sort of sick and tired of it all. And you can see it in his press conferences. He very rarely talks about football in pre or post game press conferences. It's mostly to do, you know, with, he has this ironic attitude about him and hasn't been the friendliest or warmest face. So he's never seemed to be enjoying it in the way that you would imagine somebody given the opportunity of their life.
I think I can hear Axel in the background crying over the death of Barcelona's values. And I just want to say I'm totally with you, Axel. Look, I know that Luis Enrique, having listened to, you know, so many of his press conferences and just studying him throughout the years, he isn't really a football-obsessed man. I think that, you know, Pep took a sabbatical for a year. Carlo took a sabbatical for a year. They studied the game. They found out what do I need to improve? I think Lucho takes a sabbatical for a year and he just, I don't know, goes cycling. You know, I don't think he's really a footballing kind of man. He's more pragmatic. And also, but despite all that, I've noticed some just low standards in the pedigree of Barcelona's managerial signings over the years, really since Pep left. Don't you think that's part of the problem?
Well, I would say that even before Pep arrived, I mean, Pep himself had only managed Barcelona B before taking over. Frank Rijkaard had been at Feyenoord and with a Dutch youth team. So it really was sort of a staple of the, you know, modern Barcelona in the early, you know, 2000s to now. They weren't necessarily big name managers. And there's a little bit of a fear that they will take that route, that they'll go with results-based managers from here on out, that they won't be quite interested in the how and almost exclusively interested in the what, and the what would be winning titles. This has not been the most enjoyable Barcelona to watch, you know, in terms of the totality of the season, given what we've seen. Yeah, it has been a bit, let's say, laborious at times. Yeah. Because, and you can understand, I think, why the evolution became so naturally, hey, just get the ball to those three monsters up front and they'll sort of resolve things for us. But there was this slow decay of the actual collective play that I think this season has come to fruition. And we were saying all of this as if we're having a eulogy now for Barcelona, but the season could turn around on Sunday for them, quite possibly. It does seem a bit of a long shot, given they do have some serious defensive issues, whether they play in a 4-3-3 or they play in a 3-4-3. There's all Madrid are more balanced, I think. Madrid are certainly deeper. Yeah. Even with the injuries they have along the back line. So it's all stacked against them. But it was that way after the first leg against PSG as well.
That's a good point. Christian, anything to add on the values front?
Yeah, the managerial thing is a curious one, because, you know, you look at when Guardiola was hired, it was essentially down to him and Mourinho, if you believe Soriano. And one of the reasons Mourinho didn't get it was because he didn't match the criteria that they outlined. Or outlay, excuse me. And you do wonder if on the one hand, Barcelona needs to revert to that idea of producing its own coaches as well, which is something we're seeing a fair amount in Germany with yes. Nagelsmann and people like that. But then also they have to decide again, I think, what they want. Do they want the results purely? And maybe I'm not saying him specifically, but almost go for that Mourinho type character who will just deliver what you want. Or are you going to be someone with an ethos and an ideology that that person has to fit into? The thing with Enrique I find interesting is when we talk about someone who's not obsessed, there is this very weird trend I'm noticing.
Yeah.
Sport period about you have to be obsessed with what you do. It's Conor exactly. McGregor in MMA saying I'm obsessed with fighting. It's
yeah.
Conte being obsessed with football and only sleeping for 5 hours. There's this sort of disdain towards those who have a life outside of the game. And I mean, it's weird because on the one hand, I'm a slight hypocrite because really football is the main thing that I do when I'm not even working. So I'm probably a double standard in myself there. But I think that that's the thing with Barcelona. It's you do need that person who not so much I think is obsessed with the game, but is respectful of everything that's around it. And yeah. I think that's the problem with Enrique is that as good a manager as he might be, whether he gets the results or what have you, I think he's just tired of the, I was going to swear there, but tired of the politics surrounding the situation. And if they're going to hire someone in his place, they've got to make sure that they're willing to play mediator as well as coach.
Yeah, and also to tie into our next point, I think that a lot of big teams have opted to go for really man managers, not so much. I mean, I know that, for example, I think Ferguson was brilliant tactically, but he gained, I think his legacy was mostly down to man management, getting everybody on the same page. And I don't want to compare a rookie coach to probably the greatest coach ever, but I do see a lot of that in Zinedine Zidane. Not so much as what Ferguson's done, but just in terms of getting everybody on the same page, running a very pragmatic approach. I mean, Madrid have a better team than Bayern, but Bayern are still no slouches. They're arguably the second best team in football. And, I mean, Real Madrid outplayed them. There were certainly some questionable refereeing decisions, but at the end of the day, Madrid got it done. And this has been one of the most successful rookie terms in history. So what can we make of that? Is Zidane being overrated, or has he gotten enough praise? What has been the main key of success for Zidane's Madrid?
Well, it has been man management. I think from the get-go, it was a manager who had the clout, you know, stepping into that locker room to be able to sit a Cristiano Ronaldo, to not necessarily have to win over or convince a locker room because he had been inside of it previously as an assistant and obviously carries so much clout from his time playing for the club. But their styles, I don't think you look at the semifinals of the Champions League and it's mostly, you know, quote unquote, man managers. Guys like Diego Simeone and Zinedine Zidane aren't being called tactical geniuses. You know, they're not reinventing things. I think Max Allegri has become that in recent seasons, where he's tinkered a lot more with his lineup than he used to. And he used to be known much more as a man manager than he is this year as well. But when you've got that sort of talent, sometimes it is just about, you know, keeping people happy. And I think to draw a little bit of contrast, it's one thing Luis Enrique struggled with early on. Remember last season, was it, that maybe the season before that, that some of the team captains, Xavi and Busquets, had to stop Luis Enrique from punishing Messi after he sat out with a quote-unquote gastroenteritis.
Neymar, long, too, I believe.
Yeah. Right. So he's had some issues sort of managing the locker room, whereas Zidane, that's been one of his strengths. And to have that clout, to have the personality, to, you know, the face that he projects to the media and to his players, to keep them happy despite all of these rotations. And their rotations have been the biggest difference, I think, between them and virtually everybody else in La Liga, definitely between them and Barcelona, and I would say even them and Atletico Madrid. The fact that the others, whether it's an Asensio or an Isco, Nacho, and Alvaro Morata, all of these guys come in and don't just fill a role, they produce as well. So Zinedine, I think there's a, what's it called, a temptation to say he's lucky because of the path of the Champions League final last season, because of some of the officiating decisions. Mm. But at some point you break through that threshold and yes, champion teams have a bit of luck in their favor. But I think it would be really naive to to pin Zidane's tenure at Madrid now just exclusively down to luck.
And there aren't many harder courses to reach the final than Napoli, Bayern, and Atletico.
Right.
Christian?
I think pragmatism, you talked about it there. I look at Conte with Chelsea, I look at Allegri with Juventus. I think you're seeing a slight trend between the different coaches there of a need for pragmatism. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you've got to remember that Zidane was preceded by Rafa Benitez, who I think, having seen him up close, is too structured at times, is so desperate to make sure everything is planned out that it doesn't allow for when things go awry. And we saw the stories in the likes of Ass and Marca about the players not respecting his lack of pedigree as a player, calling him the number 10 as a sort of slanted dig at the fact that he didn't play at the top level. Yeah. And I think Andreas makes a fantastic point that Zidane's ability to come into a dressing room and have already had arguably a better career than pretty much everyone in there means that no one can really snipe back, because you're chatting back to arguably one of the best players
we've
ever seen, if not his generation.
Exactly. You
know, and someone that did it for Real Madrid as well. And I think that works both ways. On the one hand, it garners him respect, but I also think it garners him an empathy in terms of he can understand the stresses that every person in that dressing room is going through, because he sat in that dressing room as a player and likely seen the white tissues of floating in his face and that kind of thing.
The Bernabeu.
Yeah, I think things like that do play a big part. And the temptation to overcorrect, I think, when Benitez left was there because, again, he had too much structure. But actually, I think they've gone for the right appointment in this one. And it is. It's so easy to say that Zidane has had it easy and that there's no great achievement in what he's done. There are a lot of good managers that have failed at that club. And again, if we're going to talk about Barcelona and politics, the same applies to Real Madrid. The same need for not just a coach, but a mediator, almost a presidential-like figure on top of what Florentino Perez will try and do. That need is great. And I think Zidane has filled a variety of roles for Real Madrid. And if they do go on and win the Champions League again this year, he's played a massive part in that, just as I think he did last season as well.
There's also, if you want to highlight just how difficult a job Zidane has, for anyone who wants to put it down to, well, he's been lucky. You look at how obsessed Real Madrid were for how long with winning La Decima, winning that 10th European Cup. Carlo Ancelotti getting it done and getting literally just one more season of credit out of it. And then you had that famous press conference where Florentino Perez was asked, you know, what was it about him that didn't
meet
the expectations? And he literally said, I don't know. Right. So it just gives you an idea of how difficult the job is, where you can be relatively successful and still lose the gig. But I think as much as
it was a fantastic season as well, that 14-15.
And we're talking about a man who's won more Champions League titles than anyone else as a manager, right? Actively, in Carlo Ancelotti. So it's an extremely difficult job, and it was always sort of for a manager who hasn't really been tested, because you could make the case that Real Madrid Castilla improved after Zidane left and got promoted to the first team. So I think it's remarkable, and we're now slowly all coming around to just how influential, as Christian said, Zidane has been in the success.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of these players, they grew up in Zidane's generation. They had posters of Zidane on their bedroom wall. So at the same time, I mean, I know that Zidane might not have every single tactical joker in his deck of cards, but he carries that weight just as his playing history, that when he's talking, you respect him. And also, to get back to the pragmatic approach, Real Madrid's main tactic is crossing, you know, getting balls into the box, and as well as set pieces. But while this might seem kind of simplistic, their two most important players are Sergio Ramos and Cristiano Ronaldo. And above everything else, what they are known for is their heading ability. So you see Pep based his team off really tiki-taka because of Xavi and Iniesta. Conte based his Juventus side off Bonucci, Barzagli, and Chiellini, because you work with what you have. So I do think that Zidane deserves a little bit more credit tactically as well.
Yeah, but and I think the thing you can say about that is it's very easy for a player turned coach to only view the game through the prism of their position and what they played. But where I think if you look at Conte and Zidane, there's an appreciation for everybody and everybody's role within that. I just did something actually for Kick on the influence of Marcello Lippi on both Conte and Zidane, and the fact that he always sought out Lippi intelligent players tactically who understood the role of everyone, so that there was no individualism in the side. And I think you look at the fact that Zidane has given a fairly prominent role, at least I think, to Casemiro. To me, that shows someone who played with Claude Makélélé and realised that, yes, it might be Zidane that was finishing off the moves, but it was Makélélé, to borrow a phrase, that was the oil for the engine. Exactly. And I think when you have that self-awareness around you, it becomes so much easier to become a coach. And I think if we look at the high-profile former players that maybe struggle or don't do so well, I think partly it's because they're used to playing with better players and they often have to start a little bit further down the ladder than the likes of Zidane or Guardiola. And then also I think the problem is they can understand the game as a midfielder, but it's not easy then to draw up a defensive plan or attacking shape, attacking movement. It's just very easy to fall into the trap of, well, this is what I would do because I'm this player.
Yeah.
And that's especially pointed with Zinedine Zidane, right? Because Zizou's not going to be able to transmit to the rest of Real Madrid's midfielders, as good as they are, hey, you know, just roulette around this guy, and then when they get it back, you take it on the volley. You look at someone like Diego Simeone, when he started his early days at Atletico, that looked very much like his position, his playing position, and that team sort of was based around that double pivot. And you could see sort of the stamp of the manager much more clearly than you could with Zinedine Zidane. So yeah, to his credit. And again, I don't think he's tried to tinker too much or to reinvent things too much. He occasionally tried a three-man backline, I think, against Sevilla in the middle of that three games that they played back-to-back-to-back. But he's kept things simple at Real Madrid. And Madrid have been for several seasons now this sort of blunt force of talent that just hits you over the head with. And if you don't complicate things too much, you can outscore teams. Yeah. You know, they're not necessarily the most solid defense, but they will outscore you. And it's a bit primitive sometimes what you see from Real Madrid, right? Because they do have this over-reliance on crosses, but you can't argue with the result.
You can't. And that is a great point that you brought up about how a manager will base his team off his own style, because Diego Simeone, above all, during his playing days, he was known for really grinta and mala leche, you know, and he based his Atletico side off that. Guardiola, above all, he was just a smart player. So really, he based his Barcelona side off tactical intelligence. Zidane, it's difficult, because Zidane was a once-in-a-generation talent. Above all, possibly the most talented player in football history. You can't teach your players that. You can't teach them how to control a volley and then slam it into the top corner from 20 yards out. But I think it's a testament to his just ability as a motivator, as well as just a human being able to relate. But for the final point that I want to touch on before El Clasico, there's always been really a debate between cartera or cantera, right? Wallet or academy. And it seemed like the past generation, it was certainly the cantera of La Masia, Barcelona's La Masia, versus the cartera of Florentino Perez's Galacticos. And I do think that this has kind of changed and really reversed over the years. You know, with Real Madrid, I think they were the cantera side of the early 90s and the late 80s, whereas now it seems like we're getting back to that, where Real Madrid are relying a lot on academy players, such as Marcos Llorente is going to come in, and Morata, Carvajal, you know, whereas Barca are putting in Galactico summer after Galactico summer. And, you know, when we get into Real Madrid's success, past two seasons, last season they brought in Asensio and Morata, both practically for nothing. And the season before, they brought in Kovacic as their most expensive signing for 40 million, I believe, which is pennies in today's market. So do you think that we're seeing kind of a role reversal from the past generation?
Well, Madrid have relied on players or bringing back some players in the case of kind of a Jale, Lucas Vazquez, and even Kiko Casilla, who's done a more than acceptable job in goal. Players who sort of know the inner workings of the club, but it's not necessarily a style dependent club. They're not married to a particular style. Whereas Barcelona, you think of having, you know, very technically gifted midfielders who can play that positional attack and that possession game. What I think, if you're looking at Barcelona in terms of have they changed their philosophy and their strategy, it would seem like absolutely the case, because they didn't go out and sign necessarily quote unquote Galacticos in this past summer transfer window. You know, it wasn't bringing Ibrahimovic in or Neymar or anything along those lines, but they were signing young players who project to be quite good, guys like Luka Digne, like Samuel Umtiti, even Andre Gomes, who was, you know, decent at Valencia. They were bringing players in for the future in a variety of positions and in places where maybe you stymie the growth of some of the homegrown kids. So there's been an absolute shift for Barcelona, but I don't know that it necessarily signals role reversal, because would anyone be surprised to see Madrid go out and spend however much it takes to get David De Gea, even though Keylor Navas is a more than acceptable goalkeeper for them, or an Aubameyang or an Mbappe or something along those lines. Yeah. So I wouldn't go ahead as far as role reversal, but I do think we've seen a change in Barcelona now with Robert Fernandez pulling the strings.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's a valid point. I think the issue perhaps that Barcelona have had is a financial one, in that they signed world-class is a subjective term, but they signed the top of the top, if you will, when it comes to the likes of Neymar, Suarez. And then I think what they didn't factor in was that to then keep those players long term, you were going to have to theoretically pay them more, because it's perhaps a little bit idealistic to think Neymar, Suarez, they're just going to want to stay at Barcelona. They're not going to need a pay up upgrade to stay here. This is Barcelona, for goodness sake. And I think when you fail to kind of factor that in, it will dramatically lower the money that you've got to play with. And I think there's certainly been some missteps. I look at Thomas Vermaelen as a good example. But then I think they've always had those kind of failings in them. You know, Kerrison jumps into my head as a good example of someone that signed and just didn't make sense in the same way that Vermaelen didn't. And I think the thing...
The Robert fella, the Brazilian that they signed for the academy, who like was overweight. It goes on.
But I think the obvious difference between the two is that Real Madrid, to me at least, seem to have this endless font of money. That's the thing. I never hear of them being in financial trouble.
That's true.
And I think what they...
Which is down to the board, down to Perez versus Bartomeu, to be fair.
Yeah, of course. I don't contest that at all. And I think that definitely helps them, because there's not as much pressure when it comes to making a mistake. You can sign, you know...
Yaramendi.
Yaramendi's a great example. I was going to say Odegaard, but you can take that risk with someone like him. And if it doesn't work out, that's fine. I think Yaramendi's a fantastic example. You can make that signing. And if it doesn't work out, it's okay. You can go back and bring someone else in. You can bring Toni Kroos in, for example. And the ability to have that freedom, I think, or that lack of pressure, just changes the way you operate as a club, because perhaps you're more willing to take that risk because it's not a risk for you.
Yeah, and Yaramendi, by the way, having a top season at Real Sociedad, whereas Danilo, who is, you know, performing poorly right now by the standard, he still was great for Porto in the Champions League. So they're signing Champions League level players, really.
Yeah, and I think Danilo has been serviceable as a backup on either side. Definitely. He's not in the starting 11. He's not. I mean, Carvajal and Marcelo have a decent case of being the best in their position on the planet. So if your backups are Danilo, and again, we've been talking about the... just how much deeper Real Madrid are. I did a thing for a show called The Extra yesterday on BN Sports, where we just played a sort of, you know, fantasy pick'em game of the others. We took apart the starting 11 for both sides, and we constructed a combined 11. And at the back, because it was just available players at the back, because of some of the injuries that Real Madrid have had with Pepe and Varane not available, you snuck in a few Barcelona players, but it was three out of the 11. It was literally Mascherano, who's had his job taken by Umtiti, so he would count as a quote-unquote other. Matthew, because there literally was no one else, and both the backups are gone. Nacho would be in the starting 11. And Digne on the left, who I think has been good, and I absolutely loved him at Roma before he joined Barcelona. The rest of that sort of, you know, fantasy squad is all Real Madrid players. It's Kovacic, it's Isco, it's James, it's even though he hasn't had a major contribution, it's Asensio, it's Lucas Vazquez, who works extremely hard, you know, in an attacking position. It's Alvaro Morata. While they can make mistakes, they can afford to make mistakes and then just, you know, sell them back to La Real like they did with Yaramendi, or just discard them as they did with Lucas the Brazilian. At least they've been giving those players the opportunities. Whereas I think Barcelona, for example, with Aleix Vidal, granted he maybe had some personal issues with Luis Enrique early on, but that lack of depth at the right back position, and sure, maybe Sergio Roberto was quite good early on, just for getting a chance to play, getting a chance to get on the pitch. Fantastic player. It's not a guy you can't go the entirety of the season with just Sergio Roberto at right back. And so they did eventually work Aleix Vidal back in and had the unfortunate injury.
I think the other thing as well is Barcelona have this slight issue where I don't think Real Madrid have an image of being talent producers. I think they take talent that's made and maybe even on the path to greatness already, whereas we've already talked about La Masia and its influence. And because of that, Barcelona have this little group of players, guys like Sandro Ramirez, Munir, who I don't think are good enough for the Barcelona first team right now, but need regular game time. So they send them out to Valencia and Malaga, and they score goals. And then instantly, every fan clamours to have them back. But when they come back, the pressure's back on. They're maybe having to be a little more kind of economical with their minutes, so they're not giving as much time to gain momentum in the first team. And that in turn leads to them then going back. And it can seem a little bit like a conveyor belt shooting them back and forth out of the club and in the club. And I think even guys like Sergi Samper, it can just be a case of bad timing. It can just be they need an extra year here or an extra year there, then they'll be ready. Whereas because Real Madrid don't have that same reliance, a guy like Nacho can sit there and really not be needed that much and still be fairly serviceable and still be fairly useful.
Against Bayern, against possibly Real Madrid, against possibly Barcelona as well. But also, to your conveyor belt example, I think several examples such as Boyan, who went out on loan for, I think, like three or four clubs. Tello, another one. You know, Real Madrid, I just think they have a better – it's more than just scouting. They know what is needed. You know, I think that Iniesta and Suarez are still some of the best in their position. But I really don't think that they've got much long-term value left. Whereas, you know, Madrid, all right, Modric is absolutely incredible. But when he starts to slow down, they've got Kovacic and Isco right there, ready to replace them. So whereas Barcelona still have a mountain of other needs to satisfy, whether it be getting a new center back, getting a central mid to bench Rakitic, or a new right midfielder. They've got a ton of other pieces of the old generation that still need replacing, and there's not enough money to do all those in the same window.
It's a good point about, for example, the Christian Tejos, as you bring up, because there's quite a few players who have left Barcelona in recent seasons who, you know, they had their reasons, both the club and the players, but there are certain players that could have contributed this year. And you look at what Gerard Deulofeu is doing with Milan, where he's been completely reinvented. And granted, maybe it's just, you know, Vincenzo Montella putting some confidence in him and making him feel special. The sort of the demands of Milan at the moment aren't quite what they are at Barcelona. Christian Tello's done fairly decent at Fiorentina. Thiago Alcantara, I mean, there was that administrative mistake with not playing him enough minutes, and so that transfer fee, instead of being 80 million or the buyout clause, turned out to be 18, and Bayern got an absolute steal out of it. Pedro, because he felt like he wasn't going to play, walks away and, you know, gets regular playing time at Chelsea. These are all pieces that could contribute to a more coherent Barcelona than what we've seen this season. But I would argue that even within the squad that they currently have, and the one example for me is Denis Suarez. I cannot for the life of me understand why Denis Suarez has had such sparse minutes. And so he gets a chance here, a chance there. He looked terrific against Sevilla earlier this season, and then we don't see him again for a couple of weeks. So part of it has been not just maybe some of the things that are happening in the front office of the club, but also the way the club has been managed by Luis Enrique the last three seasons.
All right. I think we've all reached the conclusion that Josep Maria Bartomeu is the Antichrist. So I think we can move on from here and talk about the other Champions League draw, which is Juventus Monaco. We'll talk about Atletico soon, but rematch of the 2015 quarterfinals. A lot has changed since then, but same two coaches, same really mentalities going in. What can we make of this one?
I'm hoping there'll be goals. That's the thing. It's the team that's yeah. that doesn't concede. So it's got 2-0 and extra time written all over it, unfortunately, if you're a cynicist.
Yeah.
There's a seriousness about this Juve side. This is sort of no nonsense. I tend to try and shy away from the intangibles and, you know, the things that you can't really measure. But there is something about the culture at Juve, and I've gotten a chance. I'm doing predominantly Serie A games at the moment for BeIN Sports, and I've gotten a chance to do a lot of Juventus, and they felt like that window might be closing. You know, after making the final in 2015 against Barcelona, which sort of solidified Allegri as climbing out of the shadow of Antonio Conte, because he went deeper in Europe than Conte managed to. The attitude of guys like Bonucci, Chiellini, Barzagli, Gigi Buffon, a team that's absolutely built from the back, there's a seriousness about it. They're not out there to enjoy themselves. They're not out there to play beautiful football. And I think that's a stark contrast to what you see at Monaco, where they just seem to be playing with house money, you know, for lack of a better term, and seem to really enjoy the way that they're playing. And Kylian Mbappe just looks like a kid at the park at the moment.
He does.
I wonder that contrast, that seriousness from Juve, where they're happy to sort of drag the game through the ground against the Monaco side that showed they do have some defensive problems against Borussia Dortmund. Yeah. And granted, Juve have the attacking pieces to do damage. Maybe not quite the depth, because ever since Allegri changed the system to this 4-2-3-1. He's basically played all three of his strikers and Cuadrado at the same time, so he doesn't quite have the options off the bench if he does need a goal and those guys aren't playing particularly well, or one of them goes down with an injury, because Mandzukic is on the field, Higuain and Dybala are both out there, Cuadrado is on the pitch as well. But that seriousness and that mentality and that attitude where you see, you know, even after the Barcelona victory, the celebration is sort of subdued because they know that the job is not done. They've been to a Champions League final and they lost it. They seem to me so much further along in their project than Monaco. And of course, anything could happen over a course of two legs, but they have to be considered the favorites by some distance.
Yeah,
that's the thing. I think both of these teams need to potentially try and win it this year for very different reasons. I think as Andreas made a really good point there, Juventus, I think, are very much hurtling towards the end of a cycle with this team. Whereas I look at Monaco and think, I don't think they'll have a better chance to win it than with this current group. Because I think the shift from Monaco being this team that bought high-value pieces like Moutinho, Falcao, and just didn't care for tomorrow, was just purely buying for today, that Monaco is in my eyes, gone now. It's a team that is not only trying to rear the likes of Mbappe in-house, but it's also trying to buy those players for 5-6 million, Thomas Lamar, these kind of players, and then make them worth 10 times that amount. You look at, even in January, they bought a young boy from Ajax, an Italian, Antonucci, I think his name is, for about €3 million. They're very much planning for the future. The problem with that is that once a player like Mbappe or Lamar or whoever comes along and has a good season, particularly in the Champions League, every club that's in that competition and in that last four thinks, brilliant, we'll buy that person in the summer. And you take a piece away and you have to try and replace that output without really losing a stride. And it's a very difficult thing to do. Few clubs I can think of really do it successfully. And so I think for Monaco, it really does have to be this year if it's going to be any year for them with the Champions League. And I think the difficulty for me is it could be really defining for Mbappe, because he's had this seemingly flawless season where he comes in, he scores a goal, he shows maturity long beyond his years. this is going to be, for me, the biggest test I think he's had in a long time, if not the biggest, because he's against defenders that are good defenders, undeniably, but they're also pretty much got a master's degree in the dark arts. The likes of Chiellini, for example, is definitely one of those, you know, stand on your toes type defenders. And I think that will teach Mbappe a lot. And for us as viewers, as spectators, whatever term you want to apply, we have to remember he is only 18. And that's my concern, is that we'll look at it and say, oh, maybe he's not as good then because, you know, Bonucci and all that managed to keep him out over two legs. Whereas really, his journey has just started. I'm always reminded of Martin Odegaard when he was locked in that where will I take my talents type situation with
just Strong 16 concern. Or 15 even.
And people were saying to him, you know, are you going to get called up for the Norway national team, all this, and, you know, how good are you going to be? And he said, look, I'm 16 now. I'm not going to be at my best in theory till I'm 26. I'm well aware of that. And I think that self-awareness and maturity is fantastic. And I think it's a lesson we need to apply to a lot of these players who, again, still I don't think could even drink legally in the States. That's probably a good barometer of whether a player is finished developing.
Yeah, but by all accounts, Mbappe has had that humility and has been quite smart and sort of appreciates where he is. But he's done it with relatively little pressure when you consider Monaco weren't expected to be here. Monaco weren't seriously expected to contend for the Ligue 1 title with PSG, and they're very much doing that at the moment. So the humility factor maybe helps Mbappe, and I think it would be really good for him.
Ground.
It would be great for him. Exactly. It would be great for him to if it's not Monaco next season, at least be somewhere where he's playing regularly. Don't do what Anthony Martial did, for example, go to Manchester United and then not get much playing time, which is certainly what would happen if he were to go to, for example, a Real Madrid. But Christian's point is perfect, that he is still a teenager and he's been made to look ordinary in some big games. And the one that stands out most recently was the Coupe de la Ligue final against PSG, where a defense that is quite good, but not nearly as good as Juve's, sort of made Mbappe look ordinary. They kicked him off the park early on, sort of threw him off of his game. He, to his credit, kept demanding the ball, but wasn't nearly as productive as he has been in the Champions League. And that was against Paris. Juve have proven by beating Barca, they're probably better than Paris are currently.
Much better, yeah. And to be fair, he is only 18, but I think we can agree, at least for me, he is the best teenager in world football. I mean, to score in every single Champions League knockout round, you know, whether he was going to face Juve or Atletico or Real, all world-class defenses, he has proven his worth, I think. And I think he will go down as one of the greatest teenagers in history. Now we'll have to see with all these games that he's playing, maybe he'll take the route like Wayne Rooney did, or maybe he'll actually have greater longevity. We'll just have to see. You know?
I think that's the other thing as well, is I've read so many pieces on him. I even wrote one myself, and none of them talk about what he needs to improve, or very few of them do. And I think that's one of the things that when I wrote about and tried to really delve into is, okay, he's great at this. And I sat and watched about 10 or 11 games of his and thought, right, okay, this is what he does really well, but what can he improve on? Because there is this fascination almost, I think, with this player is so great at this, but we never try to round out the portrait. We never talk about, well, you know, this could be a bit better or this could improve. And it's the same with Mbappe. I think he does a lot of things fantastically, but I think what he'll be the first to admit is there is definitely avenues in which he needs to grow and develop a bit more.
There's one other sort of pedantic, just a little detail in terms of, you know, best teenager on the planet. I think maybe best field player for his age or around his age,
right,
would be without contest. But I would say that when you watch Gigi Donnarumma play for Milan, he already looks like an elite goalkeeper. There's no way to compare Mbappe and Donnarumma, but Donnarumma is also still a teenager and is, you know, arguably for his age group, best in his position. So I'm not convinced that Mbappe is better at his job than Donnarumma is at his.
That is a fair point. But I want to touch back on Juventus because I don't want to pat myself on the back too much, but I have been saying that Juventus will win in Cardiff since Pep's Bayern knocked them out, because this project, it's so well run, so complete, really, on all fronts, whether it be really getting the stadium, changing it up and rising back to the top. of Syria in practically no time, or signing all these elite players for freeze. So I just think in terms of the project, mind you, they're doing this without Paul Pogba. So I think that we need to just, whether they make it through Monaco or win the Champions League or not, I think we need to praise Marotta and this Juventus side, really, for me, the best team in the world this year.
I think, you know, you talk about Pogba there. I think what Juventus have done really expertly, and I always remember Porto used to do this many years ago, is they would make a player look so sensational and put them in a position to succeed and sell them for a huge amount of money. And for a variety of different reasons, they would, for the most part, never really recapture the form elsewhere. And I think that's what they did with Pogba. They assessed what his strengths were, assessed what maybe he wasn't so great or wasn't so interested in, which was maybe the more defensive side of things. And I think it's interesting that Man United is doing a lot more defensively. And I think Mourinho's trying to make him just a little bit more well-rounded. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they managed to get, what was it, 89 million or some daft fee like that for him. I say that as someone who's a fan of him, but I think even he'll be first to admit he's not worth that, and there's a good chance he never will. But I think that's the key of Juventus. They realise that actually the market, for the most part, is massively inflated, but it's also a really easy way to make money if you're smart with it. And I think their ability to not just pick up the likes of Pirlo for a free, but guys like Vidal, Morata, send them, you know, take them and then make a little bit of profit on him going back, and I think could probably even try and nab him back. And then having not just the bottle to sign Dybala, but actually the ability to spot and say, we think he's going to be brilliant. I think it's very easy to look at things through. Yeah, that's the thing. I do a bit of scouting myself, so I have a little bit of experience, not near the level of Dybala, I can tell you that much. But I know for a fact it's very easy to operate with hindsight and say, well, of course this player was great. This is so easy. But actually it can be quite difficult because it's like matchmaking. You've got to take into account so many different factors, personal, professional, technical, tactical, all those kind of things, and then come up with a decision that you hope is then listened to one way or another. And I think that's where Juventus have really had a steal on a lot of their European competition, is in their ability to not just buy, but also sell and sell at the right time.
Yeah, one funny thing that you pointed out there with Pirlo on a free, it was Max Allegri at Milan who was convinced that Pirlo was done and was the reason that Pirlo did go on a free transfer to Juve.
Right.
Obviously, new life for Pirlo at that moment. But Allegri, you can't argue with the job that he's done at Juventus. It's been terrific. And in terms of the, you know, Paul Pogba, if you want to think of it in practical terms, it was Pogba for Higuain and Pjanic. And I think most teams will take that mm-hmm. any day. You're adding two starters for one. And on that point, I don't think we've seen anything even close to the best of Milan and Pjanic this season. And yet, it's been more than enough to essentially run away with Serie A once more, or at least it looks like they're going to run away with Serie A once more and potentially make it back to a Champions League final. So I think even though the likes of Chiellini and Barzagli are over 30, and Bonucci has, at least there's been enough noise around to consider that maybe he'll be gone, they've still gone out and brought back Daniele Rugani, who was terrific for Empoli. They signed Mattia Caldara from Atalanta, and he's on loan there now and is going to join Juve later. So they've continued this sort of regeneration to where they don't leave themselves a lot of holes. And if you look at just historically, now that we're no longer doing the third-party ownership thing, or at least it's been phased out, that's one way that Juve used to sort of put their hand in everyone's pocket, is they so many players were co-owned by Juventus. Now they're owned by Juve and loaned out elsewhere in Serie A, where they're getting the playing time until they're ready in season, which, for example, someone like the aforementioned Rugani had played every single minute over two seasons for Empoli, one in Serie B, one in Serie A, without getting a single yellow card. Comes to Juve, Barzagli, Bonucci, Chiellini are still there. Rugani has to sort of wait his turn, but when he does get out there, Rugani, for me, is a potential starter for the Azzurri, for the Italian national team going forward. It could be him and Romagnoli. It could be, you know, Romagnoli and Caldara as another Juve player. So they've done really well sort of regenerating, not just going out and signing players like a Dani Alves on a free transfer.
Right. And with regards to Paulo Dybala, the Pibe della Pensione, he is playing, if you just looked at the stats, you wouldn't think he's having a very good year, because in terms of goals, he's not putting up as much, but he has that new role. He's the connector between midfield and attack. And I think that a lot of people going into the season, they thought, how are Higuain and Dybala going to play in the same team? Higuain is best as the center forward in a 4-3-3. Dybala is best as a second striker. How do you fit them both in? And what Max Allegri has done, he's not only fielded both the center forwards, but he's also fielded a third center forward on the wing in Mario Mandzukic. And he's really just found a critical balance between all these players. And for me, he has been really the best manager in the world this season.
Yeah, I think you talk about Dybala's goal return and that kind of thing. I think it's a valid point that if you look at it from a superficial angle, you would say, oh, 8 goals, you know, something like 6-7 assists. It's not world-beating. What's all the fuss about?
Yeah.
But you just have to look at Pogba the other night against Anderlecht. It's him that instigates the attack. It's him that starts things off. Now, he won't get an assist for that. So you look at his numbers and say, well, he's not having a great season. But actually, it's the importance, I think, of as daft as it sounds, watching games and actually being privy to the entire situation rather than just numbers or just it. You really do need a holistic approach when it comes to assessing a player. And I think that's where we get a little bit trapped sometimes in just defining a player by those key statistics that are so often a little bit misleading.
You know what, though, and he is a bit out of position because Allegri has been desperate to find a trequartista, going as far as, you know, trying Hernanes there for a while. And so he's sort of solved that with Dybala, and maybe it's not his absolute best position. But I don't think that just because of the numbers, but watching the games as well, this is not as good a season for Dybala as the season previous. It's not a bad season by any means. I'm just saying we haven't seen this sort of exponential growth from one year to the next, whereas I think his reputation has grown tremendously from last season to this. I'm not sure that they match up his development over these two seasons with the reputation of Dybala is developing. And this is coming from someone who's an absolute, he's one of my favorite players to watch in Serie A because he is electrifying, because he does everything so silky smooth. And it really is, I'm a big fan of the aesthetic, the artistry of football. And he's one of the most enjoyable players to watch in all of Serie A. If not all of European football at the moment. I would pump the brakes a little bit on Paulo Dybala, though, just because he's being dubbed this sort of heir apparent to Messi on the national team. And I don't think he's quite to where he even deserves a mention as of yet. But he is a wonder. I don't want anyone to say, well, you don't rate Dybala. I do absolutely rate Dybala. And again, one of my favorite players in Serie A. But we are a little bit overhyping him in my estimation for a player with a fantastic future in front of him. I think he could be a lot better than he has been this year. And you could excuse it by perhaps the fact that he's playing as almost exclusively an attacking midfielder. You go back a couple of seasons to watch Dybala play at Palermo, where it's quite difficult to stand out sometimes, save for, you know, the really great ones like Edison Cavani.
It's because of Zamperini as well, isn't it? Sure. Like, yeah. If anyone takes the headlines in that club.
But the combination, I mean, watching Paulo Dybala and Franco Vazquez together was just, I mean, X-rated. It was just beautiful.
Yeah.
And Franco Vazquez, sadly, he's been one of the bigger disappointments because I really thought it was going to go very well for him at Sevilla. It hasn't. Yeah. But Dybala hasn't sort of maximized his potential so far from his days at Palermo. And that's just my one word of caution with the sort of Paulo Dybala hype train. Good as he is.
I'm not sure.
I think the thing is, as well as you look at it and, you know, you talk about an heir to Messi. Yeah. I said after the first leg against Barcelona, he reminds me more of Tevez. The yep, Messi, he's got that sort of that little pitbull in a shoebox type air to him, where he's running around, he's doing things. He's not maybe always the most graceful in the way that he does things, but the ball still ends up in the net. And I think you know you're completely right to say, and I've probably seen a lot more of him than I have, that he maybe hasn't been at the level where he should have been or grown in the right way. But I think for Argentina, I think that's possibly a topic for another time. I think that's where they need to decide what they want to do with him, because they've got Icardi sitting there as well. And I'd be really curious to see how Dybala and Icardi would play together, because you would think, at least on paper, it's a pretty good pair to mesh together.
With Messi too. But I want to I want to get back to your point on not maximizing his potential, because at Palermo, okay, he comes at 19, flies across the pond to the craziest club in all of Europe, Palermo, and Zamparini calls him the next Sergio Aguero, and he struggled for a little while until he finally realized his potential and he earns his way to Juventus. So I do think that I don't think he garnered the same hype as, for example, Ousmane and Mbappe are now. I mean, Mbappe is 18. Dybala was still at what was it, Instituto?
Tigers, bro.
Yeah, he was. Instituto, right? When he was 18. So, you know, I do think that Dybala has a future, but I'm not sure if it's as large as Mbappe right now. Even though I think he's better than Mbappe currently. But yeah, furthermore, I think that Dybala, since Pogba left, Dybala has really stepped up to become not just the future, but the star of this, at least the headlining act of this Juventus side. But I do think that with this team mentality, I think that the main star of Juventus is Max Allegri. Would you agree?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about main star. I think Bonucci and Buffon. When I think of Juve, I think of those two names first. But to his credit, Max Allegri probably took over the job and when a lot of Juve fans were pinching their nose at the thought of, okay, we'll give this a try. And he had a bit of a reputation, having talked to a lot of people in Italy about Max Allegri and how he was viewed taking over that Juve job as sort of a yes man, a guy who was going to do what the board wanted, who wasn't going to ruffle too many feathers. And he's completely broken out of that, where to the point where we're talking about him as one of the potentially top managers on the planet. It's interesting to know where he even stands among Italian managers at the moment, because obviously Antonio Conte is doing so well, Carlo Ancelotti. And if it was for my club, if it was for the football that I wanted to watch, it would be Maurizio Sarri, even though he's won absolutely nothing and has only, what, three and a half years or whatever of top-flight experience. He's just a delight to watch. Or his teams are a delight to watch, even when he was at Empoli, and it's just basically the same brand of football with you know, marginally less talented players. Well, not marginally, more than marginally. But so Allegri has gone from potentially just being a yes man, a guy who, yeah, we'll see where this goes, to a manager who can probably pick his next job among some of the world's, you know, top clubs.
Yep.
I think the thing with this Juve side is Dybala may not be the star, but I think he has an X factor moment in him, if that makes sense. The very prevalent narrative with Higuain is put him with a big chance and a big occasion and he fluffs it. It's very hard to disagree with that because, unfortunately for him, there have been a lot of moments where he hasn't taken the chance. But I think what Allegri has done very well is he's managed the situation so that really you don't feel like Juventus have a star. That's the thing. There isn't really a talisman that you look at and say, this is the one that holds everything together. You could possibly argue it's him, but when it's on the field and it's Buffon and Bonucci and Chiellini, it does feel as if they're all working in harmony together. Whereas if you say Barcelona, for example, you're probably pointing to Messi, then maybe Neymar. And I think that applies to a few different teams that are in the latter stages of this Champions League. We really do discuss them and isolate a specific player that we think is the game changer or that difference maker. And that was the case in the draw
as well. Messi and Neymar doing all the work for Barca, whereas Juve, it was a team effort.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's the key takeaway for me this season, at least in Europe, is it has gone back to being about the team again. It doesn't seem as if it's as influential when it comes to individuals. I think certainly, you know, looking through it from an English perspective, Conte has done a very good job of managing Hazard and making him feel like the star, and possibly even the same with Costa. But that's been underlined by the fact that the team has operated very well together and as a unit.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that point is also highlighted by the fact that Gonzalo Higuain is coming off of the best season ever in as far as a goal scorer in Serie A, and he hasn't even come up in the conversation in terms of who do we think of when we think of Juve. And he's a terrific striker who, as you mentioned, does have some very high-profile misses, and by high-profile, it doesn't get any higher than World Cup finals and Copa America finals for Argentina. But we are a bit harsh with Gonzalo Higuain at times. I think, for example, one of the early cases of from the Gonzalo Higuain is a choker crowd was that final match of the season a couple years back. It was Lazio-Napoli playing for a spot in the Champions League. Gonzalo Higuain scores a brace, misses a penalty kick, and people forget that he put Napoli in position with his brace and just focused on the missed penalty kick as, well, there's Gonzalo Higuain choking once more. I think he is an absolute elite striker. And there's two players that I've been defending for ages, and I feel like a crazy person having to defend them because I think they're such incredible players, Gonzalo Higuain and Edinson Cavani. With Cavani, you've seen the same thing where people just doubt Cavani because he is sort of a volume shooter and does take a lot of chances and does miss some sitters occasionally. But you know what? So does Luis Suarez, and it doesn't really fit into the narrative of Suarez. So I've contended for a long time that if you were to compile, if you made a compilation of Luis Suarez's most spectacular goals and more spectacular misses, I don't know which one is more inspiring, which one's more will leave you more awestruck, because he's missed some incredible chances as well, and yet doesn't have the same reputation. And granted, the stage matters, and for Gonzalo Higuain, there's no bigger stage in the World Cup and the Copa America finals.
Yeah, but at the same time, I do think that winning Serie A, once they signed Pjanic and Higuain from their two closest rivals, it was always kind of a given. So if Higuain can't get them across to that final stage in Europe, has he really paid back his transfer fee?
Yes, I think, I say that because there's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it and say, is he the man to score you the key goal in the semi-final and put you through? Possibly not if you go off history and you talk about the big misses. The Copa America final is probably a good example, whether it's the 2015 or the 2016 one. I think the other way to look at it is, though, he will score week in, week out in the league, and he'll probably put away the lesser teams. And when you need someone to just really fire you through the league, he will 100% do that. And so it depends entirely on how you look at your commitments during the year. Can we get through the Champions League and all that without him firing us through that same way? And even then, I think, to be honest, he has come up in the Champions League. The problem is that every time he misses a shot in a big game, it's laid on as another layer of cement to, oh, well, he only misses in big games. This is why Higuain's not a Real Madrid anymore, because he doesn't score in the big games and the big moments. Whereas really, I think that's a little bit misleading, personally. I think, yes, he has composure issues. I think, again, I was in the stadium for the Copa America final in 2016, and I remember, well, internally at least, shouting, just hit the ball, stop trying to chip it over. He was far too delicate with it. And I think there's probably a little bit of a mental hangover in his own head there, where when he gets that kind of chance, he does panic a bit. But saying that, from a pure goal perspective, and I appreciate I sound slightly critical given what I said before about Pogba, he has delivered. He's done what they wanted him to do. And I think that's take a little bit of the pressure off the other forwards so that they probably don't have to score every week in Serie A, because he can take care of that for the most part.
Yeah, but again, I think we sometimes, and I'm not accusing either of you of doing this, but we sometimes take the narrative and sort of ignore the evidence in front of us. This season, Higuain has scored against Napoli in two different games, including a brace in the Coppa Italia, I think it was the semis. He scored against Fiorentina. He scored against Roma. He scored against all of the big teams. You know, when you consider the big matches that Juve have played domestically this season, Higuain's got a fair amount of goals in there. It's not just the Cagliaris and Pescadas that he's feasting on. And yet we assume that, oh, when it's a big game, Gonzalo Higuain isn't going to score, and he'll score only against the lesser lights. I don't think that is in line with the reality of Gonzalo Higuain. And you mentioned his days at Real Madrid, because this was a reputation that was already with him when he was a very young player at Real Madrid. At Madrid, he, you know, playing concurrently at the same time as Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo, he had for some time the most clinical, or what's the word, the best scoring ratio in terms of shots to goals at that age, playing for Real Madrid on that stage. And yet he still somehow had the reputation for being a choker. It's one of the sort of mysteries, or one of the perception reality problems with football, is that we sometimes have this emotive response, and to say a player is good is to say yay such a player, and to say a player is bad is simply to say boo such a player. Mm-hmm. And Higuain is not necessarily a very likable striker, just like Cavani is not the most likable striker. They don't look very graceful doing what they do, but they're two of the best on the in the planet at doing it.
All right, who's winning the Champions League, gentlemen?
Cool.
Do you want to go first on that one?
Yeah,
I can go first.
I would take Real Madrid to repeat to wow. be the first to repeat in the Champions League. They're deeper than Juve are. In my mind, they're obviously going to have their handful of Atletico. And I'll preface this with prognosticating is neither my strength nor something I find particularly useful. But if you're asking me who the best team alive of the four is in the Champions League, for me, it's Real Madrid. I know how unlikely it is for anyone to repeat. I know it hasn't happened as of yet. But Cristiano is still at an extremely high level. Gareth Bale's coming back from injury. They're eventually going to be healthy at the back. So yeah, I would say Real Madrid to repeat.
I'm not the type
of about prognosticating when I enter rooms. It sounded perfect.
I'm not the type of man who cashes out on his bet, so I'm going to continue with my prediction that Juventus will win it all. La Vecchia Signora, best team in the world after Christmas for me. They've just got that balance, that belief amongst everybody that, like, we can't be stopped. And I know Real Madrid are the best team in the world, pound for pound. But when you look at these external factors, whether it be mentality or just that yearning, that hunger, I mean, I think that among teams who have looked, who have wanted to repeat the Champions League, I'm not sure if there's been a better aside than this Real Madrid team, but at the same time, Juventus, they've waited 20 years for the Champions League. They're hungry. And Gianluigi Buffon is playing his second to last season, so it's really looks like the final chance to deliver it, deliver old big ears for their captain, for their leader, for their legend. So I'm sticking with my pick with Juventus.
Yeah, I think I can believe that. I'm not saying it to appease our host, but I think I say that because I can imagine a Real Madrid Juventus final, and within that, I do also believe that Juventus have just got the big game management that's needed.
Yeah.
Them against Barcelona wasn't the greatest fit. Because I think really that Barcelona team was unstoppable. And compare them to Real Madrid, I think Real Madrid are stoppable. That's the thing. As brilliant as Ronaldo is, whether you want to debate the validity of his hat-trick and offside, onside, etc., I still think they have flaws and ways to be got at Real Madrid. And because of that, I just get this sense, and we talked about the pragmatism, that Allegri's pragmatism will shine through. And it may come from the most unlikely of sources, but for me, the only way I would see Real Madrid scoring in that hypothetical game is from a set piece. Partly because it's one of their strengths, but then also that's really the only time I could see a slight weakness in Juventus. And for me, I think I think they'll end that wait for a Champions League title.
Yeah. Finally, I want to touch up on probably the least talked about story of the week, but at the same time, I think it deserves its mention. Leicester City. So two seasons ago, they completed one of the most unlikely survival stories in Premier League history, staying afloat. Next season, they pull off the greatest story in football, maybe even sports history, and this season, they pull off an amazing run through the Champions League. And really, they fought hard against Atletico. They just barely got eliminated. But after pretty much 2 years of drama, chaos, it seems like this two-year party is finally over. They're in 12th, so they're not going to get relegated, but they're also not going to make Europe. So, you know, what can we make of this story? Is there any life after it, or will they just become Sorry, Christian. Another Newcastle.
I wish we'd won the league. Goodness me. You know, we discussed this on the front three this week, and for me, they're at an important juncture because when the current ownership group took over, they talked about being a Champions League team. And I must confess, a lot of people had a chuckle at that because it was, it was Leicester, without wishing to sound very dismissive.
Leicester City.
And now they're in a position where they can look at Shakespeare and say, he's had a fairly decent run while he's been here. But is that a term that we have in England called the dead cat bounce, which is as much to say that it's quite misleading and it was just a good start in the same way that Paul Clement had a good start at Swansea. And then also look at the squad and say, well, this squad got us to a decent position and can play a certain style, but is that style going to get us anywhere near the Champions League again? Or if we were to make a similar run next season playing it, will teams then go, okay, we know how to stop this. So in the second half of the season, they will sit a little deeper. They'll sit a bit more compact. They won't open up and advance onto us. They've still got a lot of financial clout, Leicester. And they've also got, I think, good currency in terms of, I think they're still respected. I think they're still thought of as a team with a lot of potential. And I imagine they're able to talk to players now that they probably couldn't talk to 18 months ago. And so with that in mind, you would have to think, if you're going to spend money, now's the time to do it. Go out, have a very clear vision with a very talented coach, maybe even Marco Silva, because I think you look at what he did with Estoril and you see a coach there who was able to get a lot from a little, but also I think is very adaptable. So if you have to sell Riyad Mahrez in the summer, if you have to sell Jamie Vardy, even Wilfred Ndidi, who I think has got a lot more potential to show, he can take that money and reinvest it in a smart way, in the same way that he did when Hull sold Robert Snodgrass and came back with Evandro and Ranocchia on loan. That ability to adapt in the market is very underrated, I think. And if I was Leicester, I'd be tempted to say, okay, let's give Silva some money to play with and actually have a good go at this, because I think if they stick the way they are, they're just going to be caught in this horrible limbo between, well, is Shakespeare really the answer? And are these players really ever going to get back to that level?
Yeah. But I actually disagree with you. I think that Shakespeare is the right man. Go ahead, Andres.
No, you don't want to expand on that a little?
Okay, I will expand on it. Look, I think that this entire, really the entire football world went insane when Ranieri was sacked. And I totally get it, because he was pretty much the grandfather we all wanted to have, you know, just cheery, fun-loving man. But talking to some actual Leicester fans, I know many actually wanted him gone. And I do think that it proved to be the right decision with the fallout between the players. And I think he has guided them to safety. You know, at some point, the clock has to strike midnight. So I do think that Shakespeare is proving to be very tactically adaptable. And I don't think the coach is the main problem. I think they need to maybe fix up their playing core right now, though.
So I've somehow managed to cover European football for over a decade in North America, and somehow very skillfully managed to avoid a lot of English football. So I've never professionally covered the Premier League.
Good for you.
Leicester are pretty far out of my my wheelhouse, even when they were on this amazing Premier League winning run. What I did find just remarkable was how much more people were invested, the casual fans or the neutrals, invested in Leicester's story and not necessarily invested in Leicester's survival, because it did seem at the time like parting ways with Ranieri, just a managerial change and the shakeup that brings to a club that is, you know, precipitously falling into the relegation zone, did seem to be sort of the responsible thing to do. And there was this incredible emotional response to the point where, you know, people were saying, well, I hope you get relegated now. Why, if you're along for the fairy tale ride, it's one of the sort of twists and turns, and it turned out to be the right decision. Now, what's best for Leicester's future? I'll just go ahead and leave you with Kristen's comments, which I thought were very intelligent.
Yep. Yeah. So that's enough for the Champions League final. I just want to touch up before we end on the Europa League. So Manchester United, Lyon, Celta Vigo, and Ajax, all special teams in their own way. I think that Ajax possibly has that factor of youth about them. Manchester United, obviously the biggest billers here, and Celta, despite having a pretty average season for their standards, they do have that advantage of being a Spanish team, which seems to always bring you European glory, whereas Lyon have performed remarkably well. So what are your thoughts on these two draws and the final as well?
I like Ajax.
Yeah.
I know that Mark Overmars was heavily tipped for Arsenal as a sporting director. But actually, I think when you peel away the layers and look at his time at Ajax, there's not really a huge amount to be impressed by, because you could argue his business or his ability to actually bring players in. His selling is very good from what I've seen and from speaking to people in Holland. But when it comes to buying, his decisions have actually inhibited the progress of some of the up-and-coming talent coming through. And I think, looking at that team now, it's not just Justin Kluivert and De Ligt. I think you look at Donny van de Beek, you look at even the likes of Nouri, who maybe aren't as prominent in the first team. This is an Ajax team that I think has a lot of potential. And assuming it stays together, I mean, I can't imagine that anyone will come in for Kluivert just yet, or even De Ligt. It could really peak in a year or two. And that's the thing. Ajax have had to change their approach, I think, in Europe, because whereas, say, 95, 96, they could put together a team of young players and really go for the Champions League. By now, the chances are if the players of that ilk are there, they're not there for long enough because someone else bigger comes in and sweeps around and uses the financial clout that they've got. I think their ability to come back from adversity against Schalke really impressed me as well, because everything about that game said they should have collapsed. They conceded two goals that I thought were really just poor goals to concede. And then Veltman gets sent off. Again, you're already writing the copy in your head that they've collapsed and showed a lack of maturity. But in Yunus, they've got this very bizarre little player that will forever dribble well and get into the position.
A little bit like Iniesta, even.
Yeah, the thing is, his move is very reminiscent of Robin to me. He loves the cut across and shoot. The problem is the ball doesn't always go near the goal. In fact, sometimes it's more likely to hit someone in the back of the stand than it is the goalkeeper.
Yeah, it's
that little fine detail. You could be hypercritical and say, well, that's why, with the greatest of respect, he's not at a bigger club, because he doesn't have that consistency. I think that for me, they're still refining some of these players. There's maybe someone like Klaassen you look at and say he should have probably left by now, but he's not. So maybe he's going to be the next CM De Jong in that sense. He's going to stay a little bit longer than he should, and it might impact his future. But overall, I like a lot of what Ajax present. And in Lyon, with the greatest of respect to Lyon as well, I think they've got a winnable draw. That's the thing. I think it's very much a team that had a truly bizarre game with Besiktas, and really was very much like the... You remember you may be too young, but I'm sure Andreas will remember, game with the two robots where you hammer the buttons. And you
of course, the boxing, robot boxing game, yeah.
There we go. I knew we had
I was too young for that. I apologize.
No, you were probably playing with computer games and stuff like a normal child. it was essentially like that, Lyon and Besiktas. It was a mad game. So I could see Ajax going to the final, and then who knows. As for Manchester United, the Zlatan injury is everything that people will talk about, and I'm sure Andreas can maybe even talk about it with more fluency and eloquence than I can.
I like both Celta and Lyon in this, to be honest. I'm almost on the other side of it, which of course means they're both going to crash out in the semifinals. Celta, I love what Toto Berizzo has been able to do there, and in big games against Barcelona and Real Madrid. especially. So they'll be definitely up for it. And despite losing one of their best players, Orellana was simply terrific for them last season and obviously had a falling out with Berisso and left the club during the January transfer window. But I love Celta's style. I love the idea of the finals in Sweden, is it not?
I believe it is Stockholm.
I love the idea of Guidetti scoring in the final in Sweden for some reason. And Lyon, I don't love Lyon defensively, but in attack, I think they're as good as anybody left in the Europa League when you consider Nabil Fekir is healthy-ish. They do rely deeply in Lacazette's goals. Corin Tontoliso might be a player that leaves in the summer transfer window, and in fact, he's been talked about as a potential signing for Juve, who are looking to replace Sami Khedira long-term. Khedira's been very injury-prone and managed to stay relatively healthy this season, but I don't know they can count on that in the long run. And when we've talked about Lyon's homegrown talent, obviously Nabil Fekir got a lot of attention, Alexander Lacazette did as well, but I think Corentin Tolisso is every bit as good, obviously in a position where it's a bit more difficult to get noticed. So again, prognostication, not my strength, but I do like both Celta and Lyon.
Yeah, and I do think it is important when you mentioned Guidetti scoring in Stockholm. I do think that Spain are going to continue their dominance in the Europa League, not the Champions League, but I do think Celta will win it, as I've said before. But I think it's important to take these contextual matters as importantly as even tactics. I think that it's not always what happens on the pitch, but also off. A good example of this is Dmitry Ribolyev, the Monaco owner. You know, his divorce with his former wife, which was determined to be the most expensive divorce settlement in history. If that divorce doesn't happen, he doesn't cut spending on Monaco. He doesn't totally change the direction of this Monaco project. And I don't think Monaco makes the semifinals. Right, isn't that also important when we're discussing these tactics and players? I think it's suffice to say that these outside the pitch matters have their impact too.
He did he not buy property or sell property?
Yeah, off of Donald Trump. Yeah, he was the one who bought the $40 million dollar mansion in West Palm Beach or Palm Beach for $100 million. Yeah,
lovely
yeah,
place.
You know, if you can't get every decision right. I think you make a valid point about considering what happens off the field as well, because what you would say now about Manchester United is they've got a very different situation in front of them than they did before the game against Anderlecht kicked off. Because, I think Zlatan is a fantastic player. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to see him in person this season and really appreciate what he brings. Yeah. They're not the same side as when Rashford's up top or when Martial's up top, because they've got that little bit of movement, that little bit of energy extra that's a little bit different to when Zlatan's in. I think he links up the play very well, Ibrahimovic. But with Rashford, there's a different aura. And so now you're looking at that game against Celta Vigo and saying, okay, they may not have the hold-up potential that they would like with Rashford. But they've got someone that's a very good finisher, actually, a little bit of an underrated finisher at times. But also someone that can run the channels and put pressure on. And so if I'm Celta's boss now, I'm looking at that situation and saying, I'm actually probably preparing for a very different team than I was before that game kicked off as well.
Yeah.
Fair point.
All right. Well, that's it. Thank you so much to the world-class announcer that is Andres Cordero, as well as future Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Christian Hanaj. It's a privilege to have you both on the podcast, and I hope to have you both on very soon. This has been Breaking the Lines. I'm your host, Zach Lowy. Until next time.